talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It's all for all of us, the sleepwalkers. And we really do sleepwalk through an awful lot of things, don't we? Right now, we're sleeping, sleepwalking right through this whole energy crisis, and we're about to hit a wall.
To talk with Art Bell,
call the Wildcard
line at area
code. Yes. Thank you. We've had that already. Instead, this. The Long Emergency, a book by James Howard Kunstler, who is my guest right now. That Long Emergency being just about to begin. James, China, before we leave the subject of China, how likely is it, as you pointed out, they have a massive number of nuclear weapons, fully capable of really putting us in a mess if it got down to that. How likely is it that as the pinch gets really severe, we could end up in a conflict with China?
Well, that's a good question. And in fact, Robert Kaplan has a very interesting piece on that in the current Atlantic monthly magazine, although I don't happen to agree with his view. Kaplan's view is that we're going to see a kind of renewed Cold War with a new Cold War partner, so to speak, and that all the action will be in the Pacific region. And I don't really see it that way at all. I actually see the world becoming a somewhat larger place. As we were talking before the break about whether the United States could indefinitely occupy these Middle Eastern nations to keep the Middle East stabilized, to sort of police the region. And my conclusion is that sooner or later, the U.S. is going to bankrupt itself or exhaust itself militarily just in that policing duty, and that sooner or later we will have to withdraw into our hemisphere.
Well, the signs of that are there now.
Well, the signs of exhaustion are there.
Yes.
You know, you raised earlier the fact that the American public in polling seems to be wearying of the great adventure in Iraq.
No question.
And sooner or later, we may find ourselves not doing that. Now, when that happens, we are going to lose a lot of our ability to control events in that part of the world where we get so much oil. And sooner or later, we may actually lose our access to that oil. I really doubt that we are going to contest militarily in Asia or the Middle East with China, with the Chinese army on land. That would seem to be a project that we could feel very little confidence about.
Well, as something happens, old Taiwan would probably be just a perfect place for, you know, some sort of something to happen.
There's every reason to believe that there's going to be mischief over Taiwan. But when you and we have treaties with Taiwan that oblige us to protect them. But when you really get down to it,
would we?
Well, when you really get down to it, I wonder whether we would do a very quick reevaluation on what our true interests were. And I'm not sure that we have an enormous interest in keeping Taiwan as an independent entity from the greater Chinese nation itself. I can't see the U.S. getting into a nuclear exchange over that. So that remains to be seen. I differ from Kaplan. I think that I don't particularly see us being able to engage with China in the way he states. He believes that the Chinese Navy is being built up to form a rivalry with the United States Navy. But it raises the question, for control of what? Well, I think the answer is for control of the sea lanes where the oil is transported. And the Chinese want to make sure that they can defend those transportation routes. But, you know, oddly enough, we now have these very important economic relations with China, which involve this pipeline of manufactured goods, you know, of all the stuff that fills up the Walmart and the Kmart, which has been, you know, coming over to us and endlessly for the last 20 years. And so you wonder, under any scenario that has us coming into serious conflict with China, what happens to the U.S. retail economy? What do people think is going to happen with that?
Well, of course, that's a two-way street, too, though, James. And since they're producing all of these things and making a great deal of money from it, they might be loath to get into a conflict with their biggest market.
You're quite right. That's an excellent point. I think what we'll see happen, in fact, will be a bit different. As the oil markets wobble, and this brings us back to the United States, as the oil markets wobble, I think that all large entities in the United States, corporations, governments, even large agricultural systems, are going to find themselves in trouble. Really, anything large is going to be in trouble, anything that is done on a giant scale. And, you know, one of the easier ones to talk about is Walmart and the businesses like it, you know, the national chain retail system that we have devised for ourselves for carrying on trade in America, a retail trade. So we depend on these enormous systems, the Walmart warehouse on wheels where they're sending 18-wheel tractor trailers continually all over America with,
oh, yes,
you know, with all these plastic wading pools and mix masters and, you know, trucks full of women's clothing and plastic flip-flops and garden tools and all this stuff coming from China, being made in China, and it's going circulating continually around the United States until it lands in the Walmart in Altoona, Pennsylvania.
Right.
This is a system that is not going to prove to be very resilient, especially in the face of wobbling oil prices, fluctuating oil prices.
All right, this gets us. You wrote a lot about suburbia, didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
All right, so what is it about suburbia? Explain that.
Well, how do we think about suburbia? You know, first of all, it's a living arrangement, and it's also an economy. It can also be viewed in sort of macroeconomic historic terms as, and this is how I would put it, the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world.
Pretty severe.
The greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world. We poured all of our post-war wealth into building this infrastructure for daily life that has one outstanding characteristic, which is that it has no future. And the future is now here. And so you have to ask yourself, what is the destiny of this living arrangement we've created for ourselves?
Why does suburbia have no future?
Well, because it depends utterly on cheap and reliable supply, on reliable supplies of utterly cheap oil. And if you subtract that, then it becomes completely dysfunctional. And
People who have commuted from suburbia into the city eventually will no longer be able to afford to do so. Is that it?
Well, that is going to be part of the picture. You know, we also have the problem that the dirty secret of the American economy for the last 20, 30 years is that it has come to be based mainly on the creation of ever more suburbia and the furnishing of it and the accessorizing of it and the servicing of it. And if you subtract all of that, you know, the home building and the tanning huts and the burger barns and the strip mall building and the automobiles and, you know, motoring around continually, and you subtract all that activity in motion from the American economy, there isn't a whole lot left besides open-heart surgery and hair cutting.
Mm.
And so, you know, people ask me, why does the American leadership seem so clueless about this issue? Why aren't they preparing the American public for this post-cheap oil future?
How would they do that?
Well, here's the problem. Well, first, let me answer my own question, my own rhetorical question. The reason that we're being so poorly prepared is that nobody wants to touch this issue about what the American economy really is, and the fact that it's utterly dependent on this chain of suburban activities, the building of ever more tract houses, the building of ever more strip malls and big box stores. And sooner or later, we're going to bump up against some very uncomfortable limits. We already are. One of them is that the middle class in America has been struggling for a while to keep their incomes up, keep their wages up. In fact, it's been a losing battle. And a great deal of the retail action for the last 10 years has simply been people giving their credit cards a workout, and we know where that leads.
Yes.
And we know that has to stop sooner or later. So the reason we don't hear about this from our leaders is that they're terrified that if this game of musical chairs stops with the suburban economy and the economy based on building suburban houses, that there won't be a whole lot left. And that means, you know, a lot of unemployed people and a lot of angry unemployed people who are going to be bewildered about the loss of their entitlement to the American dream.
So the destiny of suburbia?
The destiny of suburbia is to become dysfunctional, to lose value. A lot of the presumed wealth in America exists in the form of suburban real estate. That presumed wealth is going to evaporate. It will prove to have been a temporary hallucination.
And so the necessity driven by energy shortages will be to get people close together again, the city life.
That's one way of looking at it, but I wouldn't put it quite that way. There are other options. And you have to sort of look at other activities to see where this is going.
Other options like what?
Well, for one thing, we may not, you know, big cities are going to be in as much trouble as suburbia. Especially the biggest ones, places like Chicago, New York, L.A. New York and Chicago especially being overburdened with exactly the kinds of skyscrapers and large buildings that we're going to have trouble with in a post-cheap energy economy. But getting back to my point, you have to look, for example, to the problems that we will encounter in agriculture when the cheap oil economy starts to falter.
Okay.
You know, we produce all the food for our nation, in essence, by pouring oil on the soils of the Midwest and pouring fertilizers made out of natural gas.
That's right.
On the soils of the Midwest. And
correct.
So we have this agriculture, based on large corporate entities producing cheese doodles and Pepsi-Cola for the American diet. And that is not something that is going to continue for very long. And we are going to get in severe trouble with food production. The upshot of it all is that probably within the next 20 years, we're going to have to be producing a lot more of our food locally and in a different way, in a smaller scale, probably using a lot more human labor. I think there will be a lot of turbulent movement of people away from suburbia, and even away from our largest cities.
And all of this, you think, is driven by the coming energy shortage?
Yes, I think that the basic equation of the basic household economy of the American household writ large is going to be changing severely. It's going to require us to live very, very differently. So, you know, you said, will people move from this dysfunctional suburbia into the cities?
Yes.
I think we will see more likely that they will be moving into smaller towns and smaller cities, and the most successful places will be those places that have a viable agricultural hinterland near them, you know, an opportunity to grow food locally. And this, of course, has implications for certain parts of the country,
well,
including the one that you're in.
The implication of what you're saying is that no longer will it be viable to be delivering the groceries to suburbia, basically, right?
Yeah, basically. The age of the 3,000-mile Caesar salad is coming to an end. We're going to have to make other arrangements. But, you know, we're also going to have tremendous problems with employment as vocational niches disappear and whole industries begin to wither. And a lot of those people, I think, are going to find themselves one way or another, sooner or later, redirected into agriculture, which I believe will come much more to the center, return back to the center of American life. It's a picture that I think is very hard for the average citizen to comprehend. And yet I think that's exactly where we're heading.
How quickly, James, can you give the American people some idea of how soon it will start to become that severe?
Well, in my opinion, we will be seeing a lot of pressure on our way of life within the next 36 months. And I think we will be seeing a lot of turbulence within the end of the decade that we're in now.
Very soon is your
Yeah,
answer.
We'll see a lot of economic turbulence, a lot of population movement, a lot of jobs and industries changing and withering. I think national chain retail, Walmart and Target, et cetera, will be on the ropes within the next 10 years. and we're going to see American society being compelled to reorganize itself. And it's going to be very painful. And we're going to see a certain amount of hardship. There will be a lot of economic losers created by this process.
Does it become not reasonable any longer at some point in this emergency to be importing things from China and from other parts of the world?
Well, circumstances will really dictate what happens with that. It certainly depends how long we can maintain the kind of friendly trade relations that we have. People assume that globalism is a permanent institution, when in fact it's really just the product of a kind of transitory period of certain conditions, a certain growth medium. There was a wonderful article in the magazine Foreign Affairs about a month or two ago by Neil Ferguson, the young historian at Harvard. And he was describing the first period of globalism that began in the 19th century, just after the Franco-Prussian War around 1870, and continued until 1914. And, you know, this is this wonderful era of the late 19th century, turn of the century, sometimes known as the Belle Époque, the beautiful era. It was part of the progressive era in the United States. This era of tremendous prosperity and technological innovation, you know, all these wonderful things being invented, the car, the railroad, the telephone, motion pictures, phonographs, airplanes, you know, you name it. And tremendous global trade going on in this 45-year period. And then it all comes to an end with World War I and this tremendous calamity. And it isn't really resumed again until the 1960s or 70s when, you know, after a second world war, those nations involved begin to recover and globalism resumes. So we're in kind of the second phase of globalism.
And you're suggesting that globalism will begin to go the other way. It'll begin to shrink as the ability for easy global movement grounds to a halt. That's really what you're saying, right?
Yeah, I think that's basically it, that a lot of the procedures that are associated with globalism will wither. And we're already seeing some of them. You know, you could call the aviation industry the canary in the coal mine, so to speak.
Well, it's on its little skinny knees right now.
The aviation industry is on its knees, and things really haven't even gotten that bad yet. You know, they still have a lot of customers. We haven't even gotten to the point in America where the middle class is being really severely stressed.
That's a good point. Hold it right there. No question about what the airlines are going through. Ask anybody who works for the airlines. They really are in trouble. From the high desert, in the middle of the night, where we consider things as serious as this, you're listening to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell.
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Always follow the money, right? That's a hard and fast rule. So when you look at the oil companies, James made an awfully good point that they're not looking for new oil, particularly not investing money in that area, but instead of buying back their own stock and divesting and looking at other things. There's a very, very serious reason for that. Think about it. James Howard Kunstler writes in a very blunt, in-your-face fashion, telling you what's about to happen, what is happening with regard to energy and our economy. And it seems to me, James, that in every, even biggest of disasters, there are winners and losers. So there are going to be areas that will do and people that will do better than others during this long emergency. Can you pick out any of the winners or good places to be?
Well, this is a kind of fascinating aspect reflecting on where we're going and what's going to happen with us. And, you know, of course, I don't pretend to have a crystal ball, but I think that there are some predictions that you can make. They're already pretty clear. This period I call the long emergency will be one of economic hardship, political turbulence, and some parts of the United States are going to do better than others. I'm rather pessimistic about the Southwest.
Yes, Phoenix, I read that.
Phoenix, Las Vegas, which you apparently live near.
Yeah, that's right.
The excitement will be over in Las Vegas. Tucson. These places are going to have really severe problems. on top of the energy problems they face.
Because of?
Well, first of all, you're going to have severe problems with water. You're already bumping up against those problems, especially in the Las Vegas area.
That's quite right.
They're only going to be exacerbated by the problems that you have with petroleum and natural gas. It's hard to, you know, people think about, cheap air conditioning in Phoenix. Phoenix is virtually unlivable without some kind of air conditioning relief. You get 100 days a year with three-digit temperatures.
Correct.
And it's really hard to take, and air conditioning has made it possible. Not just air conditioning, but cheap air conditioning that most people can afford at some level.
You're absolutely right.
And, so on top of that, and water problems, and friction with Mexico, which I think is going to continue and become worse, because as the American economy suffers and stumbles, the Mexican economy will suffer by another order of magnitude, and that will tend to increase the volume of people seeking to leave Mexico and come north, even if America is struggling. And I think that friction is going to increase and become a much more severe problem.
All right, let me interject one possibility here.
Yeah.
We are, after all, working on a number of other energy sources. Now, there's no magic bullet yet, but wind energy and solar energy and some of these hydrothermal, some of these other things we're working on, biodiesel, there's no single solution, but it looks like there may be an array of possible alternative solutions out there that could, at the very least, slow what you're talking about.
Well, this is the hope of many people. And indeed, there's plenty of reason to believe that we will be using virtually all of these things in the years to come. But I would direct you to a basic formula, which is that no amount of alternative fuels or renewables or systems for using them is going to allow us to run the United States the way we're used to running it, or even a substantial fraction of it.
All right, then let's talk a little.
And so it leads to a consideration of what actually might happen. And I think what you'll see is that some of these systems of solar, wind power, hydropower, there are more esoteric ones even, I think that some of them will be used on a very local basis, perhaps even on a household basis. But we're not going to just plug and play the equipment that we're now using. You know, we're not going to run the interstate highway system on biodiesel. I've been having a correspondence with biodiesel enthusiasts by email for the last 10 days.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm rather amazed at the things that they don't think about.
Like what?
Well, for example, if you reflect on the idea that industrial agriculture in America, based on fossil fuel inputs, is going to be in trouble, and that we're going to have to change the way we do farming and food production.
Right.
One of the basic conclusions you come to is that we are probably going to need more acreage to make up for the crop losses that we will have as a result of not being able to pour fertilizers and pesticides on the soil. It'll take more acres to grow an equivalent amount of food.
Okay, but that aspect of the long emergency is still quite a ways down the road. I'm talking about the time that we become short of fertilizers.
Well, wait a minute. I'm talking about biodiesel fuels as one of the alternatives that people are proposing. And
right.
A lot of people think we're just going to take, you know, X amount of acreage and devote it to growing soybeans or hemp or algae or something that will produce oil, and that will run the interstate highway system on these crops.
Well, not in totality, certainly, but it can help, right?
I wonder if we're going to be able to do it at all. This is the point I'm making, is that I think we're vastly underestimating the amount of cropland we're going to have to dedicate not only to growing food for human beings, but in addition, growing feed for working animals, which
right.
requires tremendous amount of dedicated crop land and acreage. And, you know, the biodiesel people have this kind of weird suburban view of things. It's a kind of a gee whiz, you know, here I am sitting in front of my computer having fun making algorithms and looking at the screen, but I'm not really thinking of the real world out there. And the real world is we're going to need a lot more acreage for growing food for humans and for animals. And I'm not convinced at all that there's going to be much land that we can devote to growing biomass for these biofuels.
Okay.
I think it's a chimerical kind of a pursuit, a quixotic pursuit.
Let's talk very quickly about our leadership. What you describe must be obvious to more than just you. I mean, it's virtually a national security issue all the way around. No matter how you crack it up, it's a national security issue. So what is our leadership doing? I mean, most Americans would expect, as we look at something of this magnitude, we have something along the lines of a Manhattan Project to come up with something to stop what otherwise is ahead for us.
We are completely unserious, Art. We are lost in raptures of infotainment from top to bottom. So let me give you an example of something that we could do that we're just not doing anything about. If we could restore the passenger railroad system in the United States, we could take a very significant amount of pressure off of our oil imports, because so much of our oil is dedicated to running cars. If we could restore the passenger rail system, we could take a lot of the pressure off of the airports that are now suffering from tremendous congestion and flight delays because they're running all these flights between cities that are 400 miles apart that would be much better served by rail. We would give people a choice. It would just do wonderful things for us.
James, would people make that choice?
Let me continue for a minute, because there are additional things there are additional implications to this. One is, this is a project that is doable. We know how to run railroads. We know how to build them. We know how to fix them. All the technology is proven and established.
True.
So if we could restore the national railroad system, that would do a lot for the morale of the American public and give them a sense that they had some power to help themselves and affect their own lives in the face of these energy problems that are coming down at us. But this is the one thing that nobody wants to do, you know?
Well, let's look at it for a second. If we had an in-place efficient rail system, would people use it?
Of course they would. Certainly, if it was run at the level above the kind of Bulgarian National Railroad service that we run it at now, people will not take trains that arrive 3 hours late. You know, people will not take trains that do not show up on time, but they will take trains that leave on time, that follow timetables, that are reliable. And we just haven't had that in this country for years. And it would give people at least a significant new choice, and we wouldn't have to be running our cars all the time for everything that we do. Especially for the, you know, it's one thing to talk about, you know, making those 7 trips a day to the school, the Walmart, the soccer field, the pharmacy, et cetera, et cetera. It's another thing when you're talking about, you know, people who have to go from Columbus, Ohio to Cleveland, and there are plenty of them every day. All these people out there piloting their own vehicles, making these 325-mile trips, these tedious and often dangerous trips, you know, for people who are 70 years old behind the wheel, you know, that's not a good thing for everybody to be the pilot of their own vehicle. Anyway, you know, there are models for this in other parts of the world where it happens to work pretty well, and we just don't want to do this. You know, we're too intellectually and economically lazy to begin this process.
Well, one of those areas, to some degree at least, is a lot of Europe. A lot of Europe has pretty good rail systems and transportation within cities. Paris is great. Gee, you can bop around Paris very efficiently underground on the rails.
And you can get to a train station and hop on a train to Amsterdam and get to Amsterdam and take a tram into the heart of Amsterdam without ever having to get into a car and without suffering because of it. You know, people in Europe don't feel, they don't feel like losers because they're getting on trains. Hmm. You know, but it's obviously a different social experience. You know, you have to, you have to feel that it's okay to be with other human beings acting in a civilized manner.
It's true.
We're just out of the habit. It's not that, you know, it's not that it's such a terrible thing. It's just that we're not used to it. The fact of the matter is we're not going to be able to continue living the way we're living anyway, so we're going to have to do this whether we do like it or not. I think the nut of the problem we're talking about is why haven't we started talking about it? Why didn't you, you know, I happen to not be a Bush voter. I happen to have been a registered Democrat, although not a happy one, okay? You know, John Kerry didn't say a word about restoring passenger railroad service.
No, he did not.
And it was one of the few things that he could have said that would have encouraged Americans to feel some confidence about our ability to do things and get things done.
So if you were in a position of power, you would renew the rail system. Anything else?
I would start with that because it's such an easily doable thing and it would do so much for our national morale.
Okay. What else would you do if you had the power? I mean, what should we be doing?
We should be doing everything possible to get rid of the incentives to continue to build more suburban sprawl, because everything that we put in the ground now is going to have a tragic outcome. Every housing development that is getting started now, every new strip mall that goes in is going to be just one more dysfunctional entity in, you know, 3 or 5 or 10 years, and is going to be a tremendous liability for American civilization.
Well, your picture is kind of a downer both ways. I mean, suburbia is going to deteriorate, and cities are going to contract. So
yes,
there's going to be pain everywhere virtually.
Yeah, there is. It's going to be hard to. Nobody is going to get off easy in this tremendous period of hardship and contraction. But, you know, as we started saying earlier, some places will do better than other places. I happen to think that the Northeast and the Upper Midwest will do somewhat better than the Sun Belt.
Why?
Well, I think what you'll see in the Sun Belt is that it will suffer in proportion exactly to the degree that it benefited from the last 30 years of the final cheap oil fiesta that we've been enjoying.
But the Northeast doesn't get off the hook. I mean, why?
No, it doesn't get off the hook.
We've got to run the air conditioners, but during those long, cold winters, you've got to have the oil.
Well, we're going to have problems with that for sure. But, you know, one of the other problems in the Sun Belt is that up until really just after World War II, the Eastern Sun Belt, or the Wet Sun Belt, you know, the states of the old Confederacy, were generally agricultural states. There were few cities of consequence. There were a lot of towns, but few great cities of consequence right after World War II. And most of what happened in the South after World War II was really the result of this cheap oil fiesta and the suburban building program that went with it. And so most of the construction in the South, most of the stuff that exists is new. And most of it is not going to work very well. It's going to be a much more of a liability for people in the Sun Belt and for the kind of economy they're going to have to transform themselves into. And I think that, you know, there are all sorts of hidden consequences that haven't really begun to show yet. And one of them is this, that, you know, as this suburban infrastructure for daily living becomes worthless and dysfunctional in the South, I think you're going to see a great deal of conflict arise out of it. And some of it may even become violent as this society attempts to kind of reallocate our resources and reallocate our land for different purposes.
How do you see conflict developing?
Well, for one thing, I think that you'll see in the NASCAR belt, as I call it, I think that there is an attitude of hyper-individualism that is pretty common. The notion that the, you know, individual rights are supremely important.
There is.
And that And this combines with a romance for firearms and violence, and the idea that, that firearms should be used liberally in defense of hyper-individualism. And I think that a lot of these things will combine to produce some very unfortunate politics in the South, a politics of grievance and resentment that is liable to boil over into violence, especially with the suburbs tanking and people losing their homes and their all of their investments and their livelihoods, and I think we'll see...
a new division between the North and South?
Well, I think we'll just see, for starters, a lot of conflict in the South between the people who are hanging on and the people who are doing very poorly. A lot of this conflict may arise around the issue of the reallocation of land, because we're not going to be using it for suburbia anymore. We're probably going to have to return to local agriculture. You know, the hallmark of the period of the long emergency is that we're going to have to live profoundly and intensely local.
So we're going to have to rip up the concrete and plant crops.
Well, I don't know that we're going to be able to rip up a whole lot of asphalt. We're going to have to work around what we got. The subdivision practices of the last 50 years have been very destructive, ruinously destructive of the integrity of the landscape, so that, you know, in many places you've actually destroyed the ability of the land to be used in a coherent, integral way for farm production.
How can it be this serious, this close? I mean, you talked about 3 years.
Yeah.
This serious and this close, and our leaders not yet jumping all over it. Hold that answer, James. We're at the top of the hour. James Howard Kunstler, author of The Long Emergency. If you don't believe what you're hearing, then you might want to read the book, because it's carefully annotated. And, you know, all these things are like numbers you can add up, and the conclusions appear inescapable. Maybe there's something I'm missing, some 0 point wondrous invention that'll save us, but I haven't seen it yet. Have you? I'm Art Bell.